You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. And what a bizarre month, an unprecedented month it's been for everyone in the world, not just the astronomy and space community, of course, with coronavirus, COVID-19, sweeping the world, with health services being put under huge pressure and people working around the clock to try and keep as many people as possible safe and well. But what about the space and astronomy community? While it's very hard to argue that anyone working, or many people at all working in space and astronomy, are key workers, in fact, telescopes around the world have had their operations shut down to keep their staff safe. But what if what you work on isn't down here on Earth? What if it is, in fact, up in space through organisations such as the European Space Agency? To find out more about how ESA are coping, I spoke a few days ago, just at the end of March, to Professor Mark McCorcoran, who's Senior Advisor for Science and Exploration at the European Space Agency. And I began by asking him, even if some things are being shut down, what is happening over at the European Space Agency?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, certain things have higher priority than others. We're not only a space science agency, of course, we run Earth observation missions, for example. We run navigation systems, telecoms, and these sorts of things. And those, some of those are much higher priority than, for example, looking into the nucleus of a black hole or looking for exoplanets at this time. So we've tried to reduce the number of staff we have on site across all of our sites in Europe. And we're spread Germany, France, Spain, the Netherlands, the UK, and so on. And we're actually down at just probably less than a couple of hundred people on site out of the 5,000 staff and contractors we'd normally have. And those people are being focused on keeping the critical infrastructures working. Part of that's just sort of, you know, making sure the buildings don't burn down, but also making sure all the computers are working so that we can telework, because we're all sitting at home, set up that we can communicate with each other, as we're doing here, doing a remote podcast interview. But then some of the people do need to go on site for actual operational things, keeping the satellites running, either those which are producing data which are useful every day, or vital even, the Earth observation satellites. And one of the things we've seen, for example, you can argue it's not critical, but it's certainly very interesting input to future analyses of climate change, for example, seeing how various pollution and other measurements that we make from our satellites, how they're changing with COVID-19 as people are not working or traveling so much. And then the other satellites, the space science ones and the exploration missions, some of those we keep operating, the great majority of them actually, but some of them we've turned off, we've put into hibernation, partly because they, some of the missions, for example, Mars Express and the ExoMars missions, ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter, both at Mars, they're quite intensive in terms of the number of people. But it's also possible to turn them into hibernation and just have them go around Mars without too much orbital maintenance. So those teams have stepped back, along with the cluster mission and also Solar Orbiter, which was launched in January. That's on its way to its first flyby, so it's kind of in a cruise phase. But we've concentrated the resources then from that, or at least we've allowed those people to stay at home and a smaller number of people to stay at ESOC, our control center in Germany, to, for example, prepare for the flyby of BepiColombo, which comes on its way to Mercury. It's actually coming back to the Earth in a few weeks' time. So it's about that. It's about prioritizing, keeping things running, but trying to keep the people as safe as possible, because it's about those two things, business continuity and duty of care to the staff and contractors.
And I think it's interesting what you say about some of the Earth observation stuff and the climate change things, because there are things that that space agencies do that we probably take for granted, the kind of stuff that goes on with space agencies these days and its involvement in our daily lives. Even just weather forecasting, I guess a lot of that comes from satellite data these days.
Yeah, absolutely. you know, most people, if you've got a modern, an up-to-date smartphone, And you're navigating your way around. Of course, it might not be helpful navigating from the kitchen to the living room and back to the bedroom. But your phone will be equipped with what everybody generically calls GPS, but that's one of the navigation systems which your modern phone will use. It also uses the Galileo system, which is the European Union's version, which we built, tested, and launched and cooperate. So those sorts of things, as you say, they're invisible. They're hidden in the background, and everybody looks at the weather, and those are satellites heavily involved in predicting the weather over the coming days and weeks. But also the Earth observation missions, which are sort of taking data on agriculture and, as I said, pollution, salinity of the oceans, many of the other things which we need long-term baselines on in order to be able to make decisions about protecting the environment better in the future. If we cut the baseline, then we don't have as good a predictor for how those things are going to be changing in the long term and what we can do to slow those changes down. Because, you know, COVID-19 hopefully will go away, or we'll have it well under control, but climate change is still there waiting for us. It's a huge issue, and we play a very, very big role in monitoring it, so we have to keep that going.
And having a 6-month, a year-long gap in the data is pretty bad for that sort of stuff, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, at some level, bridging the gap would be possible, I suppose. But on the other hand, it's a sort of weird experiment as well that we're conducting here, as we turn off a lot of the typical systems which we run. We see pollution, nitrous oxide, particulates and things dropping all around the world, where you would see those things normally very high. And in a... I don't want to paint it as a silver lining, but it's certainly something where we can be gleaning from data under circumstances you could never normally do an experiment for, because you couldn't sort of say, let's turn off the economy of an entire continent in the way that we've half been forced to with COVID-19.
Mm. Now, you mentioned taking spacecraft into safe mode. What does that kind of mean? So let's take, you know, Mars Express or Trace Gas Orbiter going around Mars. So... Is there any communication with the satellites?
You put them in a mode where you can, of course, communicate with them. You stabilize the gyros. You turn most of the systems off. The orbital evolution of the satellites is well understood. For those satellites, but also for Cluster, which is in an Earth orbit, an elliptical orbit around the Earth, and then Solar Orbiter, which is on a trajectory at the moment heading out away from the Earth, but will be going to... going to Venus first and then coming back to the Earth after that. So that's the main thing, is you want predictable orbits, and you just basically put them in stabilization. I'm not actually sure what we've done specifically. For example, if you go back to Rosetta back in the day, as you remember, Rosetta went out far out into the solar system, out towards the orbit of Jupiter, and then swung back to have its encounter with Comet 67P. During that phase, far out by Jupiter, we actually put the spacecraft into a spin-up where it stabilized itself in an orientation, gyroscopically effectively, rather than having it three-axis pointed. But we did that because we didn't have much power out there, and we wanted to turn most of the systems off, including the gyroscopes on board. In this case, that's not a problem. There's plenty of power. We haven't gone anywhere weird. But we've turned the science operations off, at least. So nobody's sitting at ESAC in Spain thinking about what sorts of observations to make on the surface of Mars, and nobody sitting at ESOC then commanding the spacecraft to be pointing down at different points on the surface. And that's all, you know, that's human labor. So by actually putting it in a stabilized safe mode, we'll be able to communicate with it. We'll beam signals to it and wake it back up again. That probably through the one of the lower gain antennas, if the high gain antenna isn't pointing at the Earth, for example.
Mm. And then what about, you mentioned sort of the deep space observations are very much a lower priority. The cosmos isn't going anywhere by and large. So things like the Hubble Space Telescope that ESA co-manage along with NASA and other observatories, are they basically shut down, do you think, or is there so much of that remote that it can automated to some extent that it can carry on for a while?
Well, those are still all running. So we only shut down the four missions: Cluster, Solar Orbiter, ExoMars, Trace Gas Orbiter, and Mars Express. So, for example, Integral and XMM Newton are still operating. Hubble is still operating. Gaia is still operating. They're not, some of them are more automated than others. Gaia, as you know, is just spinning constantly, taking data, whereas Hubble is a pointed observatory, as are Integral and XMM. So they involve people planning and uplinking. Much of that work can be done from home. It can be done via so effectively telecommuting. If you like, most of our observatories are already hundreds of thousands or even millions of kilometers away from Earth in the first place. Adding another 10 kilometers from your home to space doesn't add much, except, of course, we want to be absolutely sure that when we send actual commands to the spacecraft, they're done from a fully secure environment, that they can't be hacked. So there will be people on site who are responsible for that last phase, but much of the preparation can be done at home. And the teams are communicating regularly, talking to each other, the science teams in the outside world, in the community, plus our Science Operations Center in Spain, and then the mission operators in Germany. So those things keep going, but then you've got also preparation for new missions. For example, the big one is James Webb Space Telescope, due for launch in spring to middle of next year. And there, the work has basically stopped for the time being. In order to, again, secure the safety of people, all the testing work, pretty much all of it, has been stopped at the moment. So that, you know, will likely add a delay to the launch. That, on one hand, you can sort of say, well, all right, so we launch it 3 months later, big deal. Other missions, for example, JUICE, which is going to Jupiter, that has a very fixed timeline for launch because we want to use planetary flybys to get there. And if we don't launch at the right time on the right trajectory, we won't get to Jupiter.
Right.
So actually work is continuing to the extent possible on those missions, whereas some of the other missions we're building have basically been, you know, said, but everybody stay at home, don't push it too hard. People can work from home, but there's certain meetings you need to have, certain reviews, you have to be in the room with people. So some of the missions, again, on critical timelines, they are continuing to the extent possible. Others have more or less shut down for the time being.
And I guess the hardware side of things, albeit with lots of PPE being worn when you're fiddling with a satellite in a clean room or something, but the hardware side of things is the one where, obviously, that's hard to do from home when you need to hold a soldering iron or a pair of, pair of snips or...
Yeah, well, so that's exactly right. And that's JUICE actually has various components. The Jupiter mission has various components in testing here at ESTEC at the moment. Not the full spacecraft yet, but subsystems, instruments. And so that some of that testing work is actually continuing. And those people are allowed on site under very strict controls. There's a very small number of people now. It's a very big site, as you know. Normally there's thousands of people on site, but it's less than, it's around 100, I think, now. But the test center for very critical things is continuing to operate. But there are other things, it's sort of been a slightly interesting iteration. We travel a lot, so the travel stopped very early. People picked up a lot more video cons and telecons, which we always do, but, you know, face-to-face meetings are useful sometimes. But one little anecdote is that at ESOC, where the missions are actually controlled from, it's for some of the missions, it's 24/7, and people work on shifts. And people have all been issued with their own keyboards now, which they bring into the room, they plug in, and then when they finish their shift, they take them away. So rather than actually cleaning the keyboards and going through that, it's just that keyboard's yours. If you, you know, if you've got the coronavirus, you can keep it to yourself. But there's a lot more that's going on, of course, in the sense of keeping things secure. We've had a few cases, as everybody, you know, nobody's escaped from this, but... we were pretty proactive, actually, in getting things under control quite early in terms of people teleworking and so on. So fingers crossed, so far we've been, and this is all just about the people, not about the spacecraft, you know, so far we've been done quite well in keeping people out of danger.
And then, of course, you mentioned, you know, JUICE has this very specific launch timeline. The other mission that's been pushed back, I know, is the Rosalind Franklin rover due for launch, originally going to be later this year, which is now pushed back a couple of years. That's partly because that's how the launch windows for trips to Mars work, right? I mean, there's been other things that have affected the launch schedule as well, but I get the impression that's been partly affected by the fact that there can't now be a big push.
Yeah, so it was a combination of things, and COVID-19 was definitely part of it towards the end. So the ExoMars Rosalind Franklin rover is a cooperation between ESA and Roscosmos, the Russian space agency. And the whole system had come together, the rover, the carrier module, and the descent module. where we'd been having problems at the end of last year was getting the parachutes to deploy without ripping, it turns out. I mean, these are very, very large parachutes. There are four sets of parachutes in sequence, and the first ones deploy at supersonic speeds in the Martian atmosphere. So they come out very hard and very fast, and we'd had a couple of high-altitude tests where they were getting ripped. We worked then on solving that problem. We actually had help from NASA in doing ground-based testing to show that we could modify the way the parachutes were wrapped up and get them out without ripping in ground tests. But we were then due to do high-altitude testing on that to make sure that they operated under full proper conditions. But that testing's been stopped because of the coronavirus. So, you know, that kind of put a bit of a block there. And also, at the same time, we've been having some issues with some of the electronics on some of the Russian hardware as it's come together with our ESA hardware. You do the testing. That's why you test, is to see where there are problems. And we'd found some problems, and electronics, bits and pieces were having to be replaced. So it was all kind of getting to the point where we had a critical decision to make. Can we be ready to launch this summer in July? Do we want to take the risk of launching something that isn't fully tested and then arrive at Mars and crash? Or do we want to step back and say, look, sorry, you know, we'd love to go this year, but we want to be safe. We couldn't do all the testing we wanted to do because of coronavirus. So the decision was made, as you say, to postpone effectively 2 years till the next planetary window where Mars lines up well, that we can get there quickly. We're yet to see. There are several other missions going to Mars in principle. So, of course, NASA's Perseverance rover is supposed to launch this summer. That's at Cape Kennedy already, but, you know, there's still lots of work to be done, and it needs people to do that work. I hope they get off the ground, but we have to wait and see. There's supposed to be a Chinese rover, and then one from the UAE is supposed to be not a rover, but an orbiter. So quite how many of these Mars missions in 2020 will go remains to be seen. But that window is right there. It's July to August. And I know people are working very hard to make it with their other missions.
Yeah. And as we said, Mars will still be there in 2 years' time. So at the end of the day, when it comes to keeping people safe, that's obviously the first thing to worry about there. There must be slight differences. I know that the 2020 launch window is a particularly good one for sending large masses to Mars. Is that just because of where the planets are? So there are slight differences between the launch windows, right? But nothing major as far as I'm aware.
No, I think you're right. Of course, the launch windows, you can launch anywhere in a window of about 4 to 6 weeks or so, roughly. And depending on when in that window you launch, there's certain orientations which you will arrive at Mars at. So the footprint, the kind of the area in which you hope to land, the landing ellipse, changes its orientation depending on when you launch. And that, of course, will then change depending on when you launch 2 years later. So you have to hope, and we believe that's true for our landing site, that, you know, it's clear enough that whichever angle you land at, as you come down to the planetary surface, that you'll be in a reasonably decent area.
There's not a big ravine next to it, or I guess anyway. But
yeah, if you go back to the previous, I mean, one of the launch sites, landing sites we were looking at for Mars for the Rosalind Franklin rover was a place called Morth Vallis, and Morth, Welsh word, Morth, Mars Valley. It has a big valley. If you land in the wrong place, you end up in the valley rather than the slopes above. But where we're actually going to, Oxyoplanum, is, it's not perfect. I mean, none of these places, if they're geologically interesting, they tend not to be completely flat. So there's always going to be some element of, not danger, but, you know, hope that you don't end up in just the wrong place. But there's boulders all over Mars. You can always land in the wrong place.
Yeah. And then finally, the spacecraft has robotic exploration that we've talked about. But there are also people up in space at the moment. And ESA is involved in the effort on the International Space Station, which currently, last time I checked, still had six people on board. Now, we're isolating here in, you know, various places around the world. Obviously, on the space station, they are already pretty isolated. There's not many people within a few hundred kilometres of them. What you certainly don't want on a space station is COVID-19 getting there. So is that something that's fairly easy to do? You just say, well, let's just not send anything for a while.
Well, yeah, there's actually, I think there's only three astronauts at the moment on board, two Americans and one Russian at the moment. So yeah, that comes into focus. I think a couple of them have been there quite a while as well. So I was thinking about this last week. Why not simultaneously go for the record and just say, I'm volunteering to stay up here until it's all over. No, but there, of course, would be limits there on things like the Soyuz spacecraft. Soyuz can't live forever plugged into the space station. So they will have to come back at some point. And as you say, going back, if three crew come back, then we need crew on board. So we'll have to send, we in the global sense, between NASA, ESA and Russia. So there's been quite a lot of discussion internally about how you can adapt the testing and the training that the astronauts go through. But also, it ultimately comes down to the quarantine phase at the end. Astronauts are put into quarantine before they go up. These days, it's probably not as, as sort of secure as it might have been in the past when people were coming back the other way. As you remember, when the Apollo astronauts first came back from the moon, Armstrong, Collins, and Aldrin were stuck in a sort of a reused camper van, effectively, for a number of days to see if they were bringing something back from the moon. In this case, you'll need a much longer quarantine phase in order to be sure. Do all the tests that you can. Of course, you can test for COVID-19. You can test that everybody hasn't got it before they launch. But you need that to then extend that to a rather large number of people who support the launch, support the vehicle, making sure the vehicle's clean. It is posing some significant thinking on between the agencies at the moment. There's quite a lot of discussion about it.
Mm. And of course, I mean, it's not just new supplies of people or new supplies. It's not just new people who go up there to restaff the space station. There's also supply missions every now and again from, SpaceX being one company, and then there are various missions from around various organisations around the world that go up. And I guess you don't want them to, you know, send up some groceries that have got contamination on them.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it really, it's not like this hasn't been thought of before, of course. I mean, you know, there's always things kicking around, even if you bring the flu up there, for example. You know, it's not a good thing if half your crew are incapacitated for a few days. We all know what the flu can be like, and this is something quite different. But I think, more of a reevaluation as we're all having to do on the ground. We're thinking daily about what we, you know, what does it mean when I grab a hold of that supermarket trolley, handlebar there? You know, do I touch my face or not? So I think in a sort of metaphorical sense, we're all having to think a lot harder about how we avoid contaminating surfaces and catching things from people that are asymptomatic, that they don't know that they have it. So how can you test everybody in advance? Well, at least in the space business, you can kind of put a wall around it and say, right, these are the 50 people or 100 people that need to be where they need to be. Let's test the heck out of everybody. Because you're right, I mean, the last thing we could possibly do is send it up to the space station. There's so many nooks and crannies up there that you would never be able to clean out. It's got to be avoided, absolutely. Mm. There is this business, of course, about, you know, what have we learned from the way that the astronauts live in isolation, the people in Concordia who do the testing there. There's been a lot on this, as you've probably seen on the web recently. I think to some extent, a lot of this seems a little bit like, I've got time on my hands. What can I do to help you in your isolation? And there was a thing done by the Asteroid Day people last week where a bunch of our astronauts took part. And I just saw a comment from somebody which was quite right, actually. It's like, well, astronauts and scientists, you know, they're kind of special people. They're not really teaching me anything about how I live in isolation in my small flat in London with my kids bouncing off the walls. You know, it's almost a little bit arrogant for you to tell me that you can teach me something about how I need to run my life. But, you know, the Concordia stuff perhaps is a little bit more relevant because, you know, you get locked in a space with a bunch of people you're a lot less trained, you're a lot less military, you're just, you know, doctors and scientists and people. And have you ever met Beth Healy?
I've not, no, I've not.
Yeah, well, Beth has been doing the rounds quite a lot in media in the last week or so. She's bored out of her mind. She's an A&E doctor, actually, in these days in Switzerland. She lives in Chamonix, but then commutes across to Switzerland. And she came off work with 3 weeks of leave about 2 weeks ago. So she hasn't seen the big, you know, she hasn't gone back to work to do the work with coronavirus yet. But she's done quite a lot of stuff talking about how people deal with isolation.
As you say, the experiences that people have in Concordia, being in isolation is interesting. There's also things like the Mars 500 type programs that they're preparing for what to do if you actually have, you know, you cannot have contact with the rest of the world, at least not physically. Interesting problems to try and solve.
Well, I think there's the physical aspect about all of it, but you know where Beth, and she's not a trained psychologist, but she knows some of the issues there, is exactly that, the psychology. How do you, I mean, we're weeks into this thing, right? And different people cope with it in different ways. Different people have different constraints, you know, kids running around a house or not. How does this turn out 3 months from now, 6 months from now, right? People could go completely crazy. And she had to deal with some of these weird, it's lovely stories she tells about one of the other people at Concordia. They had a fixed amount of, you know, all the supplies when winter came. They had some time when it was summer because there were loads of people on the base. You kind of get to know everybody. And then slowly but surely, everybody drifts away as winter arrives. And then you're down to the whatever it is, 12, 15 people. Bang, doors close, everybody leaves. That's it. And one of the people in her crew stole all the chocolate and hid it in the rafters of one of the rooms. And it wasn't that they wanted the chocolate for themselves, but they didn't trust everybody else to be suitably self-disciplined about not eating it all at the beginning. She wanted to mete it out that everybody would still have some 6 months later. and you say, this was just a couple of weeks into isolation, and people were saying, you know, what the hell's going on? And in the end, you know, some people went off and just basically did their work but hid in their rooms. They didn't talk to anybody for 6 months. And you try to bring them out of their shell, and you say, well, actually, if that's what works for that particular person, not exposing them. So weird stuff comes out, and I think that psychological isolation thing is something which we're going to all be facing coming weeks and months.
Well, an interesting challenge for the space sector and the astronomy and space exploration sector as well. As we said, many of these things are not critical. They're not, you know, they don't involve key workers. And as with everything at the moment, you know, thoughts and thanks go out to those people who are saving people's lives and keeping everyone healthy. But an interesting insight into what's going on in the astronomy and space sector around the world. Professor Mark McCorcoran from the European Space Agency, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Chris.
I should say that since recording that, the European Space Agency have announced that some of those missions, so Mars Express, Trace Gas Orbiter, Cluster and Solar Orbiter, are slowly coming back into operation with their teams slowly returning, or some parts of their team slowly returning to the control centres. So hopefully there'll be more science coming out of those in due course. There's been other things happening in the astronomy world as well. Reports of that interstellar visitor comet 2I Borisov possibly breaking into two. The star Betelgeuse, or Betelgeuse, brightening again, and analysis showing that it probably was a cloud of dust ejected from the surface of the star, or condensed from material thrown off from the surface of the star, and lots of other stories as well, which we'll pick up on next month. So don't forget, you can find previous episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.